Yes, and we are back. This is Warning Shots on CKW 95.9 FM. Right now, joining me over the phone is Edward Melio. Hello, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hello. Edward is an assistant professor of history and environmental studies at Amherst College. And just a little while ago, I read an article of yours in printed in the Radical History Review on control of the electromagnetic spectrum. So I guess where we should begin is explain, what is the electromagnetic spectrum?
Sure. I'm not a scientist, but I've bound up on this, especially for this interview.
Mm-hmm.
So the electromagnetic spectrum is stars such as the sun are releasing energy into space. In fact, all positively charged bodies emit and absorb radiation. It's all around us. And we measure those waves of energy that are all around us via the electromagnetic spectrum. And that's the series of waves from low-frequency radio waves, which you're using to transmit your radio communications right now to listeners, to really high-frequency waves on the other end of the spectrum, things like X-rays and gamma rays, ultraviolet radiation. And right in the middle of that spectrum is the visible part, which is just a teeny sliver of the whole sector of all this radiation vibrating around us. And those are the forms of light that you can see. But we're communicating, most of all of our communication right now on Earth is done by using this electromagnetic spectrum to send signals. So when you're surfing the web on the internet, when you're listening to the radio, when you're making a cell phone call, all of those forms of communication are utilizing this electromagnetic spectrum of radiation around us.
Mm-hmm. So now, what were some of the attempts to kind of control this, kind of by the military-industrial complex? I guess we can go back to sort of the Cold War and more with radio frequencies and things like that?
Yeah. So, well, just to back up for a second,
sure.
I'm considering in my article and the way I'm thinking about this as a historian is to sort of think of this electromagnetic spectrum as a commons.
Mm.
In other words, it's a resource that's shared among communities, it's held in common, the same way that you could think of public space, the oceans, the atmosphere, even things like heritage, outer space, the future. These are all shared assets that in some way possibly enhance our lives. And when we mm-hmm. talk about the airwaves, they're another one of those shared commons, which until quite recently, in fact, until the 1990s, have really been a public resource. But going back to the Cold War, In 1958, the United States government established DARPA, which was the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and it was a branch of the Department of Defense to develop new military technologies at the beginning of the Cold War. It was right after the Soviets launched the Sputnik satellite in 1957, and it was very much animated by this Cold War mentality of not wanting to lose out to the Soviets in the development of new militarized technologies. And that's really the historical moment when the U.S. government and the U.S. military begin to see the possibilities of using this commons of the electromagnetic spectrum as a place for increased militarization, and I argue in this piece for increased privatization, in which turning this thing that we all share in common into chunks of privatized units for sale and also for the militarization of the technologies and resources that depend upon all that radiation around us. So
mm-hmm.
There have been spectrum auctions held since the 1990s in which the U.S. government and many other governments in Europe and throughout the world have been selling rights to little slivers of the spectrum. But as you've pointed out, simultaneously, the U.S. military has been privatizing that spectrum for its own use in cyber warfare, building a cyber arsenal to operate in that spectrum in aggressive attacks on opponents.
To talk about these auctions of this space, I find that interesting. So who are they selling it to?
So they're selling it to private investors, companies that are going to choose to operate on those slivers of wavelength, bands as we call them. And then they're privatizing it for the government's use so that it's an exclusive series of wavelengths on which only certain individuals can operate, and then they can sell usage rights to those wavelengths. But the way I'm considering this as a commons, it's essentially the privatization of these resources we once all shared. And so it's been privatized increasingly for use in commercial venues, but also for use by the military.
Yeah, now, the the actual journal that the Radical History Review, I mean, in that in the one that it was your article was printed in, it was talking about neoliberalism, and you kind of make this interesting point in the article about how this paradox in neoliberalism, where it does these sorts of things, where it's apparently anti-regulation,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time it always seems to try to curtail things or control things. So to kind of talk about how that fits in, that neoliberal ideology fits into this.
Sure. So maybe, again, sorry to be defining my terms so much, but I think backing up for the listeners is useful here. So neoliberalism is a relatively recent ideology that builds upon the classical liberal traditions of thinkers like Locke and Malthus and Adam Smith. And in the 20th century, there are these new series of thinkers such as Ludwig von Mises, Friedrich Hayek, and Milton Friedman, a concentration of them especially at the University of Chicago, who build upon these ideas of small government, hyper-individualism, and universal privatization. In other words, the social marketization of all life. All life under this ideology will be subjected to market values, and they have this mantra of sort of stabilize, privatize, liberalize. And this isn't the sort of liberal and conservative we think of in North American politics, but it's the liberal of this old tradition of privatization will solve social problems. And you see in the 1970s and 1980s these new regimes coming to power, Ronald Reagan in the United States, Margaret Thatcher in Britain, Helmut Kohl in Germany, Brian Mulroney in Canada, who advocate these positions of privatizing all social services and using military power to actually open markets. But the contradiction you bring up is a really potent one, because what's going on here is they've got this regime of deregulation, but they're imposing that as a regulatory structure on the rest of the world. They're doing it in some really, really violent ways. For example, in Chile in 1973, a place that I've lived and spent quite a bit of time, in Chile in 1973, Milton Friedman and his U.S.-backed Chicago economists were able to come in after a military coup against the elected government of Salvador Allende, and they were able to establish a kind of terrarium experiment of neoliberalism where they privatized virtually every social service. And it's had devastating effects. If you've been following the news, there have been major riots and public protests in the street against the privatization of Chilean education because it's become unaffordable to most Chileans. And so there's this irony in liberalism of deregulation, but it's done through the heavy imposition of regulation, saying, hey, foreign government, you've got to privatize everything or we won't give you loans or financial aid. And so that in the article is the thing that I'm really trying to get at, is this great irony of saying that you're deregulating, but you're creating these regulations that to fall into line, everybody has to abide by all of your tenets in lockstep.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess talking more about getting back to this sort of curtailing of this electromagnetic spectrum, could you talk a bit more about this whole kind of during the Cold War about how both the Soviets and the United States and the West would kind of block radio signals from one another? So kind of talk about that, and I guess the sort of need to sort of control information.
Yeah, I mean, this really is information warfare, because what a cyber arsenal does is that it's a way to block or reroute information. And so, you know, one of the scary things about cyber war is that it can target water and electrical systems, trains. You could imagine the stock market, nuclear facilities being targets of these things. And so, you know, stemming from this Cold War mentality of an information battlefield, that's what's going on with the new cyber arsenals that are arising today. And that's partly why it's so shrouded in secrecy, that these are primarily offensive weapons. And the possibility for abuse and for domestic surveillance for political purposes is far too tempting and has no form of public accountability. And you've got to wonder, you know, where's the debate over the criteria for when and on whom you use such cyber weapons? And we reached a detente at the end of the Cold War that said, you know, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, fundamentally, nuclear war is impermissible, even though we've had scale-ups and scale-downs since then. But with cyber war, we've seen the beginning of a new arms race. And once you've crossed that Rubicon, it's very hard to turn back, because governments around the world are scaling up these cyber technologies. And it really is the control of information that's at stake here. And if you follow what's been going on in the news, experience with this program, Olympic Games, the cyber attack program that the Obama administration inherited from the Bush administration, which allowed U.S. computers to invade the computer controllers that run Iran's nuclear centrifuges. This is an example of the uses of a cyber attack, but one could imagine a whole array of unaccountable uses in which individuals who have extreme political and military power could simply usurp these technologies and decide at will what sort of material effects they want to create by disrupting information systems around the world. And that's, you know, I think that the accountability question from the standpoint of democracy with the small d is really one of the big questions here and one of the real risks.
You know, it's interesting, before you're talking about, you know, they expect, you know, everyone to follow the tenets in lockstep, and you see that with, I mean, with the NSA in the United States and the kind of data mining that they're doing on American citizens and spying.
Yeah.
And then even up here in Canada, where, in, you know, Canadians usually talk about how much better we are than the United States, but, I mean, our present conservative government, just a little while ago, there was a bill which would have allowed the police and Canadian intelligence to just basically go through people's computers, and the safety minister's words were on the bill that, well, either you're with us or you're with child pornographers if you're against the bill. So, I mean, you get this kind of rhetoric, and it's quite fascinating. But, I mean, talk about, as it relates to that, I mean, the this kind of spying that's been going on, I mean, you see that kind of stuff going on in the Patriot Act in the United States, right?
Absolutely. I mean, so the Patriot Act passed after 9/11 in October of 2001 allowed basically a widespread domestic spying program to occur using, again, elements of cyberspace and the electromagnetic spectrum. President Bush had authorized a secret order in 2002, which allowed the National Security Agency to eavesdrop on U.S. citizens and on foreigners visiting the United States. And this was framed, again, like you've said, with the child pornography aspect of the Canadian legislation in very black and white terms. This was done to protect us from Al-Qaeda. And actually what it did is it opened up a whole can of worms, a Pandora's box, if you will, of civil liberties issues that mm-hmm. the United States has been debating and fighting over for decades, if not centuries, since our very inception. And I think it should be raising more questions for civil libertarians than it actually is so far. And I think one of the great things about talking about this on the radio is the need to publicize the degree to which this is a major infringement on the democratic rights of a system that's supposedly built on public accountability and transparency. And I think it's a very worrisome development in all the different iterations that we're discussing here.
Yeah. Now, one interesting point that I thought was really fascinating in the article, I found the whole article fascinating. Obviously, that's why I have you on the show. But you also talked about, you know, after the fall of Baghdad and kind of what happened with the use of satellite receivers by the local population and sort of what the United States military had to say about that. Talk about that.
So one of the things I'm really trying to get at in my work is to think through the ways that cyberspace and the electromagnetic spectrum writ large are very, very difficult to enclose. When we talk about the transformation of the commons, of these commonly held resources into private property, we're talking about enclosure. And with this enclosure, with the privatization and militarization of the spectrum, one of the things that's happened is people have found ways to kind of tunnel in from the edges. And one of the real concerns the U.S. military had is that they were not always winning the information war. And people were able to use small satellite transmitters to access the electromagnetic spectrum and pick up Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, these local stations, regional stations, that were giving them maybe a different news impression than the U.S.-controlled spectrum was giving them over military-dominated radio stations. And so this has created a real conundrum for the defense industry because you can't always fully enclose the spectrum. It's always there all the time, and people find ways to dig in around the firewalls and the imagined fences and the real fences in this process. And that's created a lot of anxiety for policymakers because it means it can never be a system of total control. And that, I think, actually we might consider to be one of the basic forms of democracy that's being reimposed again and again on the spectrum, is that people find new ways to bury in around the edges, and that's really created enormous paranoia, actually. If you you read some of the documents that I was sort of turning up, things like the Information Operations Roadmap, which was this 74-page report released in 2003 and signed by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. It's sort of a field manual for this, and it displays enormous anxiety about how can we totally control the information people are receiving, the people we've subjugated on the battlefield, and is there any way to have this sort of total Olympian control? And it turns out that that proves really, really difficult. And so what I've been doing is trying to piece together these anxieties that also permeate the systems of control that are working through this spectrum.
We'll talk more about these anxieties that they're having in controlling, because it seems like it's like, I guess it's like trying to patch up a bucket with a bunch of leaks in it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And each time you get one patched, another emerges. And it's partly because technologies themselves are developing at such rapid rates, and people are acquiring these increasingly in more democratic ways across the board. You look at, you know, Tahrir Square, and you look at what's been going on with the Arab Spring, and then you look at social movements and landless peoples movements in Africa and Latin America. You look at the social movements in the United States and Canada. And people are increasingly acquiring access to the electromagnetic spectrum through cell phones, texting, sending messages back and forth over the internet, and there are always ways to dodge the next system of control. I mean, and I think that actually is a source for hope as well, because, you know, one of the things in a democracy you really want to advocate for is the freedom of information. And so I'm a big proponent, you know, if people are looking for sort of things to support, I'm a big proponent of net neutrality, which is this idea that it's a principle that internet service providers and governments should not be able to restrict content or participation in modes of communication on the internet. And it's got lots of advocates, sometimes strange bedfellows. But one of the fascinating things is that neoliberals have been almost universally opposed to net neutrality, which again brings up one of these contradictions. They're claiming to be in favor of deregulation, but when it comes to actually privatizing these public commons, they'll oppose anything that resists that privatization. And so, you know, one of the real alternatives for people to be out there fighting for is net neutrality, and it's constantly coming up in local, regional, and national discussions, and I'm sure in Canada that's been the case. And there's some great groups out there, like one of the ones I really strongly support is the Association for Progressive Communications, which advocates for net neutrality, but also for equality of access. And one of the things they're saying is whether you're a poor farmer in the Sahel region of Africa or you're living in rural China, you should have equal access to the spectrum. And this has to be thought out in terms of, you know, the technological access, but also in terms of spectrum access, that the spectrum is something like the atmosphere or like space that we share in common, and it should not be the exclusive domain of certain individuals or certain governments. And fighting for that is really, really a democratic battle, I think, for the 21st century.
I'm curious, so within the spectrum then, I mean, how do you view things like Facebook and Twitter? I mean, is that democratizing it? Or at the same time, I mean, Facebook is also owned by a mega corporation, correct?
So yeah. So those can be really contradictory, yeah, because they're both forms of enclosure, but they're often re-liberated for means of communication about quite progressive things. And I think, you know, working through a lot of those contradictions is also going to be part of that 21st century battle. To what degree do we allow private entities to be, you know, utilizing our profiles online for advertising and for information gathering? And I think people have to be really careful about romanticizing and sensationalizing the democratic potential of all of this, when at the same time that democratic potential is constantly being re-enclosed for, you know, profit-making and for privatization and commodification of information. So, yeah, there's some real contradictions in here that are always getting worked out. But, you know, I think it's through contradiction that we get conflict and change eventually. And so it's a process of advocacy for, you know, the aspects of these things that are truly the most democratic.
Yeah. Now, I'm also curious, I mean, you talk about net neutrality and having a more open internet, but I mean, but then the thing that pops in my mind and the thing that people will say is like, well, yeah, but then you also got stuff like child pornography. Or then, like, there's also this case in Canada of this guy who killed someone and then was mailing the victim's body parts have been showing up all over Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns out he filmed the actual act, and it's all up on the internet. So then there's those kind of questions.
Yeah.
So then, again, it's one of those contradictions. So where is there a halfway point here? How do you transverse that?
Yeah, so, I mean, this is one of those essential questions about free speech, you know, that freedom comes with not only enormous responsibility, but it comes with real questions about how you regulate the uses of those freedoms. And I think one of the great lessons of the commons is that there have really been ingenious local and regional and international institutions and customs that have long found ways to democratically manage their common resources. And, you know, sometimes that involves the role of the state, but at other times it involves communities deciding to shun individuals that have clearly gone beyond the bounds of reason or morality or ethics. And I think that kind of democratic imposition of principles is really important, a non-tolerance of certain types of behavior in the commons. Now, again, that raises contradictions and questions about who gets to legislate those norms, but that's part of the really exciting debate about the commons, is it's a sort of one theorist who talks about this, Eleanor Ostrom, calls it a polycentric form of governance rather than a centralized mode of top-down decision-making about who gets the right to speak. It's multiple players enacting those roles within a common space. And it's challenging and difficult, but if you look at examples of managing the commons democratically, you have this really diverse array of examples like Swiss Alpine cheesemakers who have very careful regulations for grazing common pasture, or Maine lobstermen who get together and figure out what the fisheries quotas are going to be for their fisheries, or Bolivian citizens who resisted the privatization of water in Bolivia since 2000 and are managing their water as a commons, or even software developers who are using Linux and open source code software, where it's analogous to the free speech issue. It's a bunch of people getting together and allowing the commons to be manipulated democratically, but then they have to come up with a series of rights, principles, and codes to help monitor the limits of that behavior. And I think it's a much richer process than simply saying we're turning to either the state or the market to surveil and decide about how this commons is going to be used.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm curious also, too, because one of the reasons why I wanted to get you on the show was also to kind of talk about CyberCom, because you talked about the sort of cyber warfare. You know, CyberCom was created a little while ago, about a year, 2 years ago, I believe, and so it's the United States Strategic Cyber Command, and they've already carried out numerous exercises in cyber warfare and cyber defense. So how do you view that, this kind of massive, I guess it's the NSA and the Pentagon kind of getting together on this?
Well, there are a couple answers to that. And one of them is, first, it's been very worrisome that we've not seen the so-called peace dividend. This was the promise, and it was actually the elder George Bush and Margaret Thatcher who made this promise to us, that at the end of the Cold War, we would see the dividends of the reduction in defense spending, and those would be socially distributed so that people around the world would benefit from the end of this bipolar conflict. We haven't seen that, and what's gone on is that the investment has simply been in new forms of war escalation, and cyber warfare is one of them. And then the second thing is sort of what I brought up earlier, which is, where's the debate? Where's the debate over the criteria for when CyberCom and on whom CyberCom will use these weapons? And it seems, as I said before, like these are primarily offensive weapons. The whole justification that they're defensive, I noticed in the report you gave me, Colonel Charles Williamson III, in the Armed Forces Journal of May 2008, talks about CyberCom needing the ability to, quote, carpet bomb in cyberspace.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is clearly not something where the justification any longer, even at the rhetorical level, is one of defensive of U.S. domestic interests. But this is a very aggressive program that is clearly aimed at disruption of foreign adversaries on their own turf. And I think that's one of the most worrisome signs, is that this is not even rhetorically justified as you know, in that Orwellian term with homeland security, mm-hmm. but this is actually clearly framed even in their own rhetoric as an aggressive offensive weapon.
Yeah, and I think even just recently I was hearing about there was a massive cyber attack to many Middle Eastern countries as well, that they mm-hmm. It was deleting certain information from government computers and things like that. So I don't think CyberComm claimed responsibility for it, but you begin to wonder, you know.
Do.
Yeah.
And again, in a democracy, the accountability is the key question. Where do we as the American public, or, you know, in Canada as the Canadian public, get to intervene? And you know, is it just every 4 years in an election or ever how many years for Parliament or Congress? And that just seems like a very limited conception of democracy. And this is one of the most worrisome things is when you see the massive centralization of power in small agencies controlled by a few individuals who have enormous resources at their disposal. It just starts to seem much more like an autocracy.
Mm-hmm. Well, but I think, like you said, like framing it as in the electromagnetic commons is the important aspect of this, because I don't think, and especially like how you talked about it as a resource, even in my own thinking, I'd never really thought about that too much. But when you do think about it, I mean, access to that, to things like whether it would be texting, email, the internet, radio, such as right now, for the public, thinking of it as a shared resource, I think is definitely key to this whole debate.
Yeah, and I think the reason it's so important as such is because, you know, if you look at situations in which dissent is made possible, it's one of the mechanisms of accountability. Or you could think of the electromagnetic spectrum as a resource for a small farmer trying to get weather data and manage risk, or, you know, in terms of communication among family members of migrants who are living at tremendous distances from their home. These are all ways in which people should be able to use this global resource in an era of globalization democratically, and the worrisome development is this enclosure in which we're all displaced from our access. And it, increasingly, it's a smaller and smaller number of individuals, corporations, and governments that have usurped control over this thing that's all around us at all times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you think that there are analogs to this. There was this proposal in 1993 by a Georgia-based space marketing company to launch a 1 square kilometer illuminated mylar sheet into orbit around the Earth, and the thing would have been roughly the same brightness and apparent size of the moon. And that caused enormous outcry. In the end, it was actually only stalled because of risks of space debris and lack of funding for the proposal. But that is a great, very tangible example of an enclosure of the commons. I mean, imagine if your kid or grandkid can never look up at the night sky and see the dark night sky illuminated by the moon and the stars. You'd have a Kentucky Fried Chicken or Reebok ad beaming as bright as the moon. That's a way to put it, I think, into context. The same thing is going on with the electromagnetic spectrum. It just is less apparent because such a thin sliver of it is visible light, but it's all around us as well, and it's also being turned into a private resource. And I think if you think about the sort of space marketing company analogy there, it makes it a little more tangible for people to think about. You wouldn't be happy about that, right? But yet, you know, we're allowing this to happen with the electromagnetic commons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, I think everyone can relate to that. I mean, even on Facebook and such, I remember, you know, liking a movie or something, and then all of a sudden all these ads pop on the side for buy this, you know, Big Lebowski t-shirt, and, you know what I mean, stuff
right.
like that. And it's like, well, how the heck do they know that?
Right. And the average North American is being exposed to 4,000 to 5,000 ads a day, and we're traveling in buses that are wrapped in them, and, you know, everywhere we turn, there's an ad popping up on our phones. Every screen we look at, ads are – and you have to wonder, when will we decide that enough is enough of this colonization of our visual commons with all of this advertising? And it is again, I think, framing these things as a commons allows us to kind of conceptualize how we might resist and how we might start to rethink the way that these spaces get constructed and reconstituted.
Mm. Well, Well, Edward, well, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this. I mean, as usual, I always like to talk about things that are sort of not talked about enough in the news. So thank you very much for coming on and giving your time and explaining this very, very critical issue.
Thanks so much. I enjoyed myself greatly.
Great. Well,
take care.
Yeah, take care. Have a good day. That was Edward Manlio from Amherst College. He's a professor of history and environmental studies. So do stay tuned. We will have more warning shots coming up, just kind of closing out the show. But do stay tuned. This is Warning Shots, CKW's independent international news show on CKW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.